I'll leave that where it is. Today, I'd like to draw from the first chapter of this book. The title includes the expression Early America, which is a field that once existed, a field of history that no longer exists. I don't teach what I teach in early American history and in Atlantic history and in British imperial history. One cannot put that in a book title, however, so I chose the title that belonged to a very good research institute at the University of Pennsylvania, the McNeill Center for Early American Studies, consistent with that. But the book reaches quite a bit beyond the American setting and certainly begins in an imperial context, or certainly begins before empire, with a figure that I call an imperialist before empire. That figure was a gentleman called Edward Randolph, who was one of the first imperial agents sent across the ocean to investigate and effectively police the colonies and get them to behave much better. And he struggled with the process of communicating with his superiors in the metropole and wrote poignant letters full of complaint about what people in the colonies were doing, but also strong feelings of isolation and inefficiency and frustration. So some of those letters will resemble, at least in tone, the letters that many of you are familiar with in your work, and certainly feelings of isolation that need to be overcome, since that is what the Republic of Letters was all about. And that is what I will address today from a slightly different perspective, not through networks per se, but through the creation of an infrastructure of communications in the late 17th century and an ideology of why communications is important. And I'm going to use the word communications slightly anachronistically, but I think it's important to capture what happens in the late 17th century. So my paper today will overlap sort of the heyday of the Republic of Letters and the late 17th century moment when the Republic of Letters, I think, is transitioning from a set of networks to also having a layer of organized societies, for instance, and learned periodicals, and operating not simply in a world of manuscript exchange of letters, but transitioning to some institutional basis for the exchange of ideas and the negotiation of intellectual relationships and intellectual discussion in the latter 17th century. A parallel development that may interest you, it certainly interests me, is what happens in the business and financial world in the same era. This late 17th century seems to be a crucible of innovation, and certainly in the business world you see the emergence of the financial press, for instance, and business periodicals, and a great premium on business information. In given institutional weight and not simply informal weight. So there's a good deal of scholarship about that. I think there is still less scholarship outside my book about the same story looked at from an imperial perspective, or giving provisionality to that, the construction of an empire long before it is recognized as such. I'd like to do this emphasizing rather emphatically the historicity of this, even if I'm using a slightly teleological term in terms of empire before it exists and in communications before it exists. But I really would like to emphasize the provisionality of constructing these things, constructing an infrastructure of communications. And as you'll see, I'll trace the hard work and the mistakes and the experimentation that was required to create something that can be recognized and was given recognition as an infrastructure that could serve many different constituencies of people. And I'll focus on one constituency in particular, and I'll make what I hope is a provocative remark at the end and compare that constituency to some of your favorite people. And I'll just say I can call them people like us, as you'll see toward the end. But I really would like to emphasize the provisionality of what was undertaken in this time period and what difficult work was involved. So I'd like to begin with communications infrastructure in the national setting of England and its sense of competition in this. I'm going to talk about the 1650s initially, and its sense of competition not yet with the French, which comes a little bit later, but with the Dutch, because you see the English very earnestly pursuing this kind of international competition through colonization actions, trying to colonize places in the Americas and to seize Dutch colonies, such as New York, through two episodes of warfare, through its navigation acts, which were meant to regulate the practices of international commerce, transatlantic commerce, trying to disfavor the Dutch, and through postal acts. And this is where communication comes in. There are two postal acts in this time period, 1657 and 1660. So this era is an era of serious revision on the part of the English government and how it looks at the rest of the world. It is not yet any kind of futuristic vision of grand empire, but there's certainly a good deal of adjustment and innovation in this time period, enough so that it can be thought of as a turning point in a shift from an epistolary culture to a communications culture, which is an argument I'd like to end with. We all know from all the letters that you read, and I have read, how much self-referentiality there is in these letters about letters that do not make it to their destination and letters that are delayed. And their incredible obsession, not just with the difficulty of sharing ideas, generating and sharing ideas with other intellectuals, but simply in how to communicate with other people and the networks that become very important, the informal networks that become important to try to render this a more reliable process in some way. And this is... had long been in early modern culture a normal circumstance, that letters would be written, that they would be lost, that they would be delayed, that the entire process of communicating with people you'd like to communicate with was fraught with difficulty. The normalcy of that, I think, is going to disappear in the English context, at the very least, in the 1650s and beyond, with the notion that that delayed and lost letters are a problem, not normal, and that they are a problem that can be solved through government intervention. And that is precisely what happens. I'll just read a little moment from the Postal Act of 1660. Many letters have been detained long to the great damage of the merchants in want of that speedy advice and intelligence. And the Act also talks about the miscarriage of many letters. And that's what inspired English lawmakers to replace all the fragmentary ways that letters were exchanged between people through private arrangements, informal arrangements, as best as they could organize, with something of a public system of conveying letters. And this is not so much of a technical achievement. There is no postal system, but it is a conceptual leap that you can create a postal system. So there's nothing there. The acts don't refer to post offices or postal routes or anything like that. But suddenly they decide that there can be people made responsible for rendering communication reliable and efficient between people. The fact that a letter should get from point A to point B, someone should be responsible for that. And that is the conceptual leap they make. They create these positions, a postmaster general with an extraordinary amount of authority. We would all like to have this amount of authority to just be told to do this. Perhaps it's a burden to bear, but also you can do whatever you want. There is no direction in these postal acts about what the Postmaster General of England is supposed to actually do. What they do, however, is create postal routes and post offices and appoint postmasters. And so that within a generation, you have something that becomes a permanent feature of English life, which is a postal system and a recognized permanent feature of English life. Again, from very little, if nothing, to something quite substantial. So by 1678, and this is less than a generation, the headquarters of the post office had moved around from place to place, and by 1678 it was moved to a permanent location in London in the Financial District on Lombard Street, where it would remain for the next 150 years. And that was situated in such a way as to be near the center of administration in England, the center of internal trade between England and other parts of the British Isles, or the, what become the British Isles, and the center of overseas trade. So London is the central place, and by 1678 you have a central post office in London. By 1671, just the descriptions of this come in slightly scattered fashion, but by 1671 there are 77 employees working in that general post office in London, and there are 182 postmasters staffing post offices in market towns throughout England and Scotland. And post offices become a standard feature of market towns in this generation. Here's a guidebook from 1681, for instance. There is no considerable market town, but hath an easy and certain conveyance for the letters thereof to and from the said grand office. And here something is installed and put into the English landscape that becomes a recognized feature. The aim, of course, is to connect domestic productivity in England, economic productivity in England, to advantageous trade outside of England. And the reach of this is as far in these in the notions surrounding this is as far as Turkey and Syria, for instance. So that's the extent of the reach in terms of the geographical horizon that they reach for. It does not include the across the Atlantic. It does not include England's own colonies. So it's not, it's more of a commercial rather than an imperial vision. In 1677, the entire system is officially surveyed by someone, Thomas Gardner, who goes along every postal road to every post office and develops a survey of this. And he describes this quote-unquote six great roads radiating out from London towards six terminals linking England to the other British Isles and to the European continent. So there's a road that links goes west to Bristol, connecting it to Wales. There's a road northwest to Holyhead. Pardon my I don't have an English pronunciation of everything, even though my partner is English, so pardon my stumbling. Holyhead, I'm sure, is not pronounced Holyhead, but that's what I'll say. Holyhead, connecting it to Ireland. Berwick, connecting it to Scotland. Did I do Berwick correctly? Berwick, I'll say it the American way. Berwick. Then Yarmouth, connecting to Holland. Kent, connecting to France and Belgium. And Chichester, connecting it to Spain and Portugal. So there are different, here you can see the roads radiating out and trying to link everything into London and to all of these places, which are the main routes of external trade for England in this time period, with the colonies as an afterthought. But it's at this point, when you look at this, in 1677, after the 1657 Act is able to invoke nothing, is to able to give open instructions to the new Postmaster General. By 1677, you have what I think can be called a communications infrastructure that links a central place to market towns, has routes, and connects to overseas trade, and serves the complexity of a fast-developing nation that might have hints of empire to it. This will connect to the articulation of an ideology of modernity. Next, that this process has two phases. There's the implementing of it and putting things into place, and then there's the process of recognizing its worth and turning that worth into a stimulus for more innovation. And this is what's going to happen in the next phase in the 1670s and 1680s. You see a new wave of entrepreneurial innovation, people who take the raw structure of this postal system and find ways to add to it, make it more complicated, make it more dense, and give it intense value, partly into support of their own entrepreneurship. One of the first people with this regard is John Ogilby, who develops the first road atlas of England in 1675. 200 pages of maps and directions for people to navigate England, and he credits himself. He says, the king has been great about connecting us to the rest of the world, but my great contribution to the English nation is to show this wonderful system of roads that we have here, and I can produce an atlas. And so there's one small moment of innovation that you'll see in a moment magnifies even farther. That's 1675. In 1680, there's another entrepreneur, William Dockwra, who decides that London can't just be served by a general post office. It needs lots of post offices in the neighborhoods, and it needs lots of post riders. And you should be able to deliver mail and pay a penny, and someone will deliver the mail for you. And this is the development of the penny post, which of course becomes institutionalized in the future. So this is his innovation, and it's all part of a notion that you can promote an infrastructure in order to enhance the communication capabilities of a place, that communication, if it's enhanced, will promote trade, and that trade, if it's enhanced, will promote prosperity and glory of a place. And those places magnify between London and England as the places that will be best served in this way. And this is an ideology that appears in Ogilvy and in Dockwra, that this is a service being provided that has national implications. In Dockwra's case, it is almost immediate. It's immediately successful, and it's immediately taken away from him by the Duke of York, who has been granted the monopoly on the postal system. There's no mention of any penny post in that monopoly when it was granted to the Duke of York in 1663. But needless to say, when it enters the courts, that the Duke of York wins the lawsuit and is given the penny post, and it's absorbed into the post office. One interesting element of this is the nationalist element, but also the economic element. There's a vision of an economy here that's very specific. It's very undifferentiated. It's an assumption that there are lots and lots of people who contribute to that economy. And it's the aim of an economy, or a stronger economy, is not premised on competition. That's not the route to strengthen the economy. The way to strengthen the economy is to connect everything. And this is the ideology that's articulated by people like Dockwra, very, very intense. I can read you one lovely quote. Perhaps you'll see it as lovely as I am, as it overlaps with scientific discourse. For as money, like the blood in natural bodies, gives life to trade by its circulation, so correspondence, like the vital spirits, gives its sense and motion. And the more that these abound in any place, the more doth that place increase in riches, strength, and vigor. And I love the rhetorical strategies that Dockwra is using there. And it's those kinds of rhetorical strategies that appear over and over in justifying this kind of innovation, whether it's the Road Atlas or the Penny Post or the other innovations that I'll discuss in a moment. These ideologies that sort of hinge on the economic function of communications, and I'll conclude with that again, I want to come back to that point, slide though into another ideological claim that's not simply based on economic ideology and the economic function of things, but on a discourse of modernity, which is the discourse that's in my title. And it's this new discourse of modernity that appears in more and more places in the late 17th century in public discourse in England, and it's intensely comparative, as I'll hope to demonstrate in a moment. And it hinges not simply on economy, but on communications especially. So here's one quote from Edward Chamberlain in 1674. Though the number of letters missive in England was not at all considerable in our ancestor days, yet it is now so prodigiously great, since the meanest people have generally learned to write. And this is, Chamberlain is writing a book mostly about those on high, government structures, the bureaucracy, overseas trade, the economic resources. He writes a series of editions of a book called Anglia Notitia, or The Present State of England. And he's trying to describe what makes England so great in its competition with Holland, and especially now increasingly with France. And he was very careful as part of this process to note the communications infrastructure, not just the letter writing process, but he describes the dozens of employees in the General Post Office in London, the postmaster station throughout London and England and Scotland, and the packet services that connect England to all of these other places on the continent. And so this is part of his explanation of why England has been attaining such glory and such modernity, and communications becomes one measure of this. And here, I'll give you another example that's not simply in the terms of the quantity of letters and letter writing and postal employees, but something a little bit different. Letters are conveyed with more expedition and less charge than in any foreign country. Perhaps most superlative were the, quote, flying coaches between London and various market towns in England, coaches that traveled, quote, with such velocity and speed as that the posts in some foreign countries make not more miles in a day. And there the language is not so beautiful. It's a little gnarled, but he's making an argument that the roads are so good in England and the postal system is so fast that it is coaches that can travel as fast as horses can travel in other countries, and it is coaches that can speed along and carry the mail swift as compared to, especially his points of comparison are Holland and France, and it is England that he claims through the superiority of its communications, its resources, its government, that is ushering a new era of modernity. So there's an ideology of modernity that is trumpeted increasingly, and one of the measures of that modernity and of national appraisal and of national supremacy is this communications infrastructure. This is the 1670s, and it intensifies in the subsequent editions of his book. There's also another innovation, which is less ideological and not... Edward Chamberlain, you may recognize the name as an intellectual in this time period, or someone with intellectual pretensions and a good deal of bombast in his writing. But there are books that serve another kind of constituency that have much more technical and practical orientation, and that are also a kind of innovation that are put forward in the culture, and that's guidebooks to cities and to countries. The first of these is the City and Country Chapman's Almanac, published in 1684, and it's just a list of market towns and postal roads and not much else. But this guidebook quickly becomes popular. People want such a thing, and it develops into a genre, a competing genre, so that different constituencies can buy different guidebooks that are oriented to them. And these books become thicker and thicker and full of information about every facet of commerce, transport, travel, and communications inside London and throughout England. And so I'll just give you some sampling of the things that they include. Lists of market towns, post roads, postal rates, postal schedules, packet services, penny posts, city streets, stagecoach services for passengers, hackney coach services for passengers inside London, wagon cart and boat services for transporting goods, currency conversion tables, weights and measure tables, interest rate tables, price tables, and so on. And this becomes an important genre that's a little bit different. It will set up a recognition of this extraordinary spatial density of networks in London and in England, and a claim that they are the best in Europe, but also a currency of scheduling, that everything is on a schedule, and these books are filled with all different schedules where they equip you to know if you need to get something from point A to point B, this is where you do it, and this is how you do it, and this is when you do it, and it will enable you to do that efficiently and reliably. Whatever it is that you want to move, whether it's yourself, a good, a letter, or anything else. And so there's a premium here, not so much on modernity in some ways, but on something that's related that becomes very important in the culture, I think, in the late 17th century, and that is currency of information, that you need to be able to do things, not just, so it's a little bit different from knowledge, the production of knowledge, and a notion that knowledge is a stable thing. Information is precisely unstable, and it constantly needs updating, very different from a knowledge regime. So these books become very popular, and they themselves are offered as a measure. So in 1708, Edward Hatton, who's once an insurance surveyor who writes one of these books, would proclaim that it's not the city of London that is the acme of modernity in the world. That claim is being made, right, that London is the greatest city in the world. Some people still claim that for some reason, I'm not sure. But he claims that London has the best guidebooks in the world. They have a more particular description thereof than has hitherto been known to be published of any city in the world. So not just the best city, but we have the best guidebooks. We have the most current information about everything in our city. And I don't mean these are guidebooks, not tourist guidebooks. These are reference books for residents, visitors, et cetera, et cetera. Not a guidebook in, I'm sorry, that term is a little bit slippery. Finally, I'll just do one more measure of related measure. It's also can be put into the communications world. And that is a common denominator binding together everything. In the book, I also describe the emergence of engineering, for instance, as a discipline, and applied mathematics in terms of developing this elaborate infrastructure of all of these things that relate to transportation and communications. But the thing that holds everything together, the domestic economy, overseas trade, government bureaucracy that we all know is increasing in this time period, is a documentary culture. Everything is premised on paper. And this becomes a point of great pride. By 1674, there's a writer who writes one of these boasting books who says, "No nation uses more paper than we." And here's another index of why England is becoming ascendant in the world. More modern, more capable, more thickly organized, more efficiently organized, more vibrant, more dynamic, more effective, more successful in the world. This will attach to the question of empire that I'd like to come to. Was that I'd like to use that as a way of thinking about the Republic of Letters and getting closer to your own main concerns in your collective undertaking. This is a very much a commercial vision of England and its commercial reach. It's not an imperial vision yet. It does not include the colonies, and there's still the process of conceiving what an empire might be. Using the language of empire just starts filtering into English public discourse in this time period. The notion that the colonies constitute part of an empire also requires some conceptual work, never mind some practical work. And it requires both, and I wanted to emphasize the conceptual and the technical work involved in building an empire and the provisionality of it. Because there are colonies, but there is not yet an empire. The figure that I mentioned very briefly, the isolated figure, the first imperial agent to be sent abroad to fix things, a fixer, as it were, Edward Randolph, is sent once again. He goes abroad, I think, seven times. He's sent back and forth to fix things. In 1685, he goes back. He's trying to make a little more money, so he takes on some extra positions, and one of those is he wants to be postmaster for Boston, or for, in this case, he called deputy postmaster of New England, which is effectively Boston in this time period. And he reaches Boston, he finds there is already a postmaster in Boston, and he wonders about this. And here you can see the fragmentary quality of empire, that the imperial bureaucracy does not really know what is happening in the colonies, and the colonies are innovating without knowing what's happening in the imperial bureaucracy. Let me see. Oh, can I beg you to just do the...
Absolutely.
Yeah.
There's
a neck. Great. Just to give you some, this is John Ogilby, who does other atlases besides his atlas, his road atlas of England. This is one of his books. And I just want you to get a sense of the primitive state imagined, at least in England, of what the colonies look like and how you can see there's a ship, there's some connection to the outside world, there's native peoples very close by, there's a militarization of settlement that's very, very apparent. There's no connection to any other settlement. It is very coastal. This is the English vision, at least, of what the colonies are. It's not entirely accurate, but that doesn't matter. This is what it's expected to look like. If you look at the next slide, this is John Ogilby's image of England. That's what I was doing, too, and I wasn't having any luck. And here, this is a little hard to see. There's a militarization here. You can see the cannons facing inland, interestingly enough. But you can see the geographers in the front and the surveying crew that's about to go out and the road networks that connects. It goes up into the hill. There are zillions of ships in the harbor. And there's a much more developed sense of what England looks like in this time period. And it's that primitive quality that's very different in this time period, at least in their vision of what things look like. In 1672, for instance, there's the first time that a colonial governor needs, under threat of war by the Dutch in New York, he needs to communicate with Connecticut and Massachusetts, hoping to marshal allies in the fight against the Dutch. And he has to hire a courier to go, and he expects the courier to blaze a trail to Connecticut, to invent the trail that does not exist. There are no roads, et cetera, et cetera. He also expects the courier to capture army deserters along the way if he happens to bump into any army deserters. So it's a real theater of the absurd in this time period. But there's very, very little capacity for intercolonial communication except through London in this time period. And certainly the English don't imagine it. In the 1670s, there are postmasters in the three main cities in the colonies. 1670s and early 1680s, Boston, Philadelphia, and New York City, the one that surprises Edward Randolph, who thought he'd be the first one. In 1688, there's a postmaster installed in Jamaica by the imperial government. Jamaica is thought of as a strategic place in the Caribbean. There's attempts to have a postmaster there that involves lots of wrangling between the government and the assembly in Jamaica for many, many years. And finally, the imperial bureaucracy in 1688 gives up and just installs somebody. And also, very importantly, installs the principle that the postmaster general in London has authority to create a postal system and do whatever it wants in the colonies. And this is the beginnings of something that can be called an imperial vision, that this is the responsibility of the Postmaster General to do so. And this is what makes the government receptive to a crazy entrepreneurial figure who is in charge of organizing gambling entertainment of the king, and he's also master of the mint, who's making a mess of things that will have to be fixed by someone who might be familiar to you, Isaac Newton. Somewhat marginal figure, I think, in the history of science. This person is Thomas Neal, who makes a mess of things and who tries desperately to make money, more of it through all these speculative ventures, one of which is to develop mines in Virginia, another is to raise up shipwrecks in Bermuda, and another is to create a postal system in the colonies. And after much winding its way through the English government bureaucracy, and everyone wants a piece of the discussion, every department of it wants a piece of the discussion, this project is approved with the notion that the Postmaster General can farm out this activity to Thomas Neal. Thomas Neal will develop it. He's given a certain amount of time to do so, but it still belongs to the Postmaster General. Thomas Neal is indifferent to the project. Having started it, he farms it out in turn to someone named Andrew Hamilton. Andrew Hamilton is an enterprising Scotsman with some experience in the colonies, which Thomas Neal has absolutely none. Never been there, never interested in going there. Andrew Hamilton has been there as an investor in New Jersey. Thomas Neal taps him on the shoulder to go and do something about the colonial postal system, and at the same time, Andrew Neal is appointed governor of New Jersey. So Andrew Hamilton goes. He appeals to all of the other governors of mainland colonies to support a postal system, to try to figure out a way to organize it through the governors. The governors say, sure. And that's all that they say. They offer, there's nothing further that can really be done except nominal support. But out of this nothingness, Andrew Hamilton manages to develop something. Even as Thomas Neal is declining into greater controversy and into bankruptcy, even as Edward Randolph, who's still investigating the colonies and who hates Scotsmen for whatever reason, and gets Andrew Hamilton fired for having a position he's not entitled to. So Andrew Hamilton has to go back home to London to try to get his position back. He succeeds. Neal goes into bankruptcy, and Andrew Hamilton can boast that there are a few hundred miles of a postal system in the colonies at this time. That's as much as he can generate. He claims that there are a few hundred miles. He is reinstalled by the imperial bureaucracy and goes back to the United, to America, and dies. However, he articulates something, and it's the articulation that is going to matter. He articulates something for the empire and how a postal system there can be more effective. It should not be under a royal patent with all the risk displaced onto an entrepreneur. It should be a royal commission funded and financed by the government, et cetera, et cetera. So he thinks very, very carefully about how a postal system can be put on much more solid ground. He runs into the practice of ship letters that I'm sure you're very familiar with, that it's the common practice for ship captains to transport mail from place to place in exchange for a penny. Andrew Hamilton says this is doing intense damage to the postal system and that they need a packet service that connects the two. So he has a much more careful vision. He has learned from the difficulties that he encountered in his decade in control, even if he wasn't able to do very much. He was able to claim that there are X number of post offices. I forget the exact number, which is right here somewhere. I think it's 14. Now I can't find where it is, but I believe it's 14. And his vision is enacted within a few years. And here the 1711 Postal Act is the important one. And that Postal Act does articulate an imperial vision of the postal system. It tries to connect the English postal system to the Scottish, to the Irish, to the colonial. Very keen to centralize and again to construct not just commercial reach for England, but imperial dominion for England. It also tries to turn that postal system into a revenue stream for the government to pay for its wars against France. So all the revenues that it would generate would not be reinvested in the postal system itself, but would be absorbed into the war effort. That absorption of those revenues continues even after the wars end, unfortunately, for the postal system. But in this moment that you get something different, which is, James, if we can have the next image. This is another atlas by Herman Mole, perhaps a name familiar to you, as an early atlas maker in the service of the English government, or now the British government. He develops a book of maps really intended to demonstrate British claims against the French in all its newly won territories. And here is his image of what was a long time ago contested terrain in the New World between England and France. If you look at the next image, though, the important feature is in the bottom right-hand corner, which is this is the first description of the postal system in the colonies that's put on a map and put forward as part of these imperial claims. The one final element that Hamilton asked for was transatlantic packet service. And this comes from yet another entrepreneur that's going to go bankrupt, Edmund Dummer, who develops a plan for packet services. He runs into even more difficulties because packet services already exist to the continent and have been utilized for a few decades. So more people in the imperial bureaucracy want say in this project. But finally, there's a deal made where Edmund Dummer is going to provide 4 ships per year to go back and forth to the West Indies. There's an assumption that he would raise £8,000 a year through this process in income, and he would be given an additional subsidy of £4,500, with the assumption that it would become more popular, that the subsidy could end, his income would increase, and he would keep any profits. And that's the deal, of course, an entrepreneur makes in this time period. Reality was very different. Within 2 years, his debt had ballooned to £53,000 and had become completely untenable. He reports very sadly over and over and over how the French keep taking his boats, how the shipyards are very slow in building new ones, and he has had to have the personal expense of building many more boats than 4 in order to sustain 4 boats. And he soon dies bankrupt. But it is this packet service that is mentioned in the 1711 Act, even as it collapses. There's another packet service, again by an entrepreneur, this one named William Warren, who develops packet service to New York City in this time period. starting in 1709. It is also mentioned in the Postal Act, and William Warren goes bankrupt. He doesn't die as quickly as Edmund Dummer upon bankruptcy, but that packet service falters at the very same time as the Postal Act imagines that it exists and can connect England to its colonies. So what you are left is an English postal system that is very fiercely connected to the British Isles, would have become the British Isles, and to continental Europe, and this colonial postal system that strings together the port cities of the colonies together and stands in isolation with the assumption that tobacco ships and timber ships will carry the mail back and forth, and ship captains will enjoy the pennies that they get for each letter that they carry. This is what begins the process of, there are of course Americans that participate in the Republic of Letters already in this time period, and this is what they do. Those in New England are using timber ships generally to convey letters back and forth. So here we have a communications infrastructure that at least is imagined to be imperial, even though it is very, very provisional. It is replete with infighting within the imperial bureaucracy about who's going to finance, regulate, etc., both the postal system and the packet services, which are generally a mess. This brings me to 1715, the end of the period I'd like to cover, and this map, which is on the verge of when Ralph Allen famously is going to thicken the English postal system to an extraordinary degree in the 1720s, and the communications infrastructure of England is going to leap that much more. This does not happen in the colonies until the 1750s, when it's Benjamin Franklin, who's the innovator, who does something similar to the colonial postal system. And it's not until 1755, amid war, that there's a new packet service established between the colonies and England. So what I want to emphasize in all of this is, one, from the imperial standpoint, which I think comes back to the difficulty of the informality of the Republic of Letters, but something we call the Republic of Letters, which is a term they used, and it is also a teleological term, but the sheer difficulty of conceiving and constructing something as complex as empire in this time period, and having communications be an important part of that, I hope can be appreciated. And that's the spirit in which I tried to write this chapter, the long, long process in which the notion of an English empire was understood, and which it could be technically accomplished, not only to understand it, but to take the elements of it and to turn it into an effective empire that's able to compete with other empires in this time period. More pressingly, perhaps, it is, and this relates perhaps to the present day, unfortunately, when I say people like us, it is not intellectuals and scientists who are able to turn themselves into the social constituency that's identified with a public service that's to be provided by the government, even if it's in halting ways. It is merchants who are able to articulate an ideology of why they are worthwhile to a nation, and they turn themselves into a social constituency that is served by government, that government does things for because they are imagined to be important. And we can lament this, perhaps, with respect to the Republic of Letters, that intellectuals are able to do this through patronage networks, of course, and establish value. But when it comes to government institutions, there's a new world, and that world into the 18th century is going to serve business and commerce much more than it's going to serve science and any other intellectual enterprises. And that's what people like us can sadly consider an unfortunate aspect of this early modern moment in which business trumps science and intellect, and it certainly is the case in the present day, when we see government serving business interests first and foremost and turning universities into lapdogs of business, unfortunately, as a government enterprise. So here it's that identification that somehow it is business constituencies that are able to generate an ideology of value and to turn them into the equivalent of a public. Again, not a group of people, and this is the intellectuals and the scientists who constitute the Republic of Letters are not able to turn themselves into public. It's obviously a ridiculous notion with respect to the business community in this time period, but they are still able to do that no matter how ridiculous it is. The 17th century has been analyzed, I think, very carefully and effectively in terms of the development of institutions out of informal networks, which has been very valuable. I've tried to add a component of what is entailed in developing an infrastructure, not simply institutions, but an infrastructure is something broader and is closer to how this time period was able to turn very, very small fragments beset by great difficulty into systems that endured. The English postal system not just endured, but it thrived and became very, very important, and the colonial postal system at least survives. It does not die off. It survives and then becomes much more important later in its life. So simply to think about networks and institutions, I think, is very valuable, but I would like to add a clarion call for thinking in terms of infrastructure and systems as well. I'd also like to add a clarion call for the hard work of recognizing the importance of something, because that is the part of the intellectual process that happens here, is people have to recognize the importance of something and then assign it value and then promote that value. And there is hard work, which is why I've emphasized in the title of my paper, Ideologies of Modernity. It's not just the technical achievements and the difficulty of those, but it is the promotion, giving them ideological meaning so that there is government subsidy and public support for these things, public support for those government subsidies. And that is done through the two ideologies that I've mentioned, an economic ideology of communications and how it serves domestic trade and overseas commerce, and an ideology of modernity that serves national glory vis-a-vis in comparison with other rival nations. And finally, the last point is all of this, I think, is part of a transition from something that was very dear to me in my first project, and a phrase I thought of very often, which is an epistolary culture, and how important epistolary culture, all the self-referentiality of it, the beautiful letters that we get to read about the intellectual activities that people grapple with in noble ways in the past, but how they grapple with the process of sharing those ideas with like-minded people, finding those people and discussing with them. And I just love the word discussion in a very, very meaningful sense. And that's part of the beauty, I think, of an epistolary culture. And certainly, I did not just read the letters of intellectuals in the course of my book project, but many, many beautiful people, many beautiful letters for many, many different reasons as people grappled with the world in which they lived and struggled to be effective in that world in different ways. But I think we have an epistolary culture, and why I wrote a book about letter writing and communications is I think there's also a communications culture. The epistolary culture had been there for a long time, obviously, since classical, there's classical reference to that. And there is a communications culture that's been written about, that's often about related to diplomacy and government service, but it becomes something public. It becomes a communications culture, I think, in this moment. France becomes important in this, but England is appoints itself certainly as the great nation to achieve modernity in this time period through, among other things, not communications alone, but through the fundamental importance of communications to the national project. And I think that's when you have a communications culture that's different than simply a letter writing culture. It makes different demands on our analysis, and which is why in this book I try to weave the two together to appreciate the personal dimension, but also the structural dimensions that it exceed personal agency and personal capability. Network theory, for instance, is very, very interpersonalized in a lot of ways. And I think infrastructure and communications culture ask something different in terms of how we understand and appreciate the creativity and innovation of the past. And I'm sorry, I don't have a... Oh, the watch is behind me. Oh, okay, there it is. So I should end right there. Thank you very kindly.